The Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, is a federal program that provides health insurance to kids and families that aren't eligible for Medicaid but still can't afford private health insurance. CHIP enjoys rare bipartisan support on Capitol Hill, but Congress has not yet renewed funding for the program after its expiration in September. To find out how CHIP works and what the loss of CHIP funding means for families in Hawaii, conversation producer Ryan Finnerty called Judy Moore Peterson. She oversees the local CHIP program at the Hawaii Department of Human Services.
The CHIP program, or the Children's Health Insurance Program, is, as its name implies, health insurance for kids. It's different than the current Medicaid program because it is health insurance that for families who make too much money for the traditional Medicaid program, which is a very, very low income sort of threshold, but they also cannot afford insurance on their own. So that's in general what the program is.
And what is that income threshold to be eligible for Medicaid?
Today, for an adult, for a family, it's about 138% of the federal poverty level, and the CHIP program goes all the way up to 308% of the federal poverty level. To put that into perspective, a family of four that was at the 138% of the family of the federal poverty level, they're making about $39,000 a year, and a family that's a family of four. At the 308% of the federal poverty level, are making about $87,000 a year. So you can see there's a big difference there.
So that 138% is a nationwide number. It's not adjusted for cost of living or incomes in a given state or municipal area.
Well, the federal poverty level standards, they are national standards. It just so happens that both Hawaii and Alaska, we get our own federal poverty level standards, but yes, in general, it doesn't matter. It is that standard across the country. But when it comes to the CHIP program, states have the option of providing coverage at different federal poverty levels, and so our state has chosen to cover CHIP up to 308% of the federal poverty level.
Okay, and so for families that are eligible for this program here in Hawaii, it's just the kids, right? It's not the parents that are eligible for CHIP specifically?
That's correct. This is a children's health insurance program, so it does provide health insurance coverage for the children. The states can operate the CHIP program differently. So you can operate it as a separate program, or you can run it as actually part or an extension of the Medicaid program. Here in Hawaii, one of the reasons that you may not have actually ever heard of it before is because we don't run the program as a separate program. We actually run the program as part of our Medicaid program.
So when it comes to funding, since Hawaii has one consolidated program, do we still receive separate sources of funds from Washington?
Yes. Like the Medicaid program, the CHIP program is it's partially funded by the federal government and it's partially funded by the state. However, the amount for every $100, for example, is very, very different between those two, what we call a federal match rates. So, for example, or to put it into perspective, with our Medicaid match, for every $100 that we spend in the Medicaid program, the federal reimbursement is $54.78, whereas on the CHIP program, for every $100 that we spend, $91.35 are being paid for by the federal government, and just that remaining $8 or so is being covered by the state. So you can see there's a really, really big difference there.
Okay, and Medicaid and Medicare funding is written into law, so that funding's not in jeopardy. But CHIP, as I understand it, is not, and Congress has neglected to renew funding for CHIP, and it's since expired in some states around the country, Colorado and Virginia, have even begun sending out letters to notify families that their coverage is going to expire. How has the lack of renewed funding in Washington affected the program here in Hawaii?
Right. That is exactly right. So far, the federal government, Congress, has not reauthorized the CHIP program. It does run differently than the Medicaid and Medicare programs, and so it does need to get reauthorized. And the authorization actually ran out at the end of September 2017. But because it is funded a little bit different in that we're given a certain amount of money and we can spend up to that amount of money, we did have some additional funds that we could continue to draw down. So some states have already gone through their entire CHIP allotment funds. And because they operate the program as a separate CHIP program, they are going through the process now of sending out notifications to those families. However, the good news for the families that we cover here, the CHIP kids that we cover here, because we run it as part of our Medicaid program, we will not be sending out notifications. We will not be terminating anybody's health insurance coverage. So that's the good news part. The challenge for us is that although we will continue to provide coverage, we will no longer get that higher match rate. You know, you may recall I talked about getting out of every $100, getting $91.35 for the CHIP expenditures. And we will only get the $54.78 once we run out of our CHIP allotment. So that creates a budget crunch for us. So the good news is no families, no kids are going to be losing their coverage. The challenge, of course, is that it does create a budget crunch for us.
Okay, so because of the joint program that you're running here in this state, the loss of CHIP funding federally is not such a big deal, but there is still going to be a shortfall. Would that have to be made up locally at the state level, or is there another source of federal money that could be used to make that up?
We will have to make up that shortfall, it's not an insignificant amount that we have to think about. Our estimations are that we have about enough of our CHIP allotment dollars to last us until into February. So we still have some additional time. We've done some estimates of what we think the shortfall would be, and it's in the multi-million dollars that we're estimating there would be a shortfall should there still not be any reauthorization of CHIP. And if that's the case, then, of course, we will work with the governor's office and the legislature on ways that we would be able to come up with that additional funding. There's no other than the Medicaid match, which we've already talked about, we have to look at state funds then to make up that difference.
So we're getting ready for the 2018 legislative session here in Hawaii. Have you or your office started engaging with legislators to explore potential solutions to this funding shortfall should the situation not resolve itself in Congress?
What we've done is we've informed them that there would be a shortfall should it not get reauthorized. Well, there's a huge political, you know, question mark as to whether they will authorize it. Most people believe that eventually Congress will do the right thing and that they actually will reauthorize the CHIP program. It's been a very popular program on both sides of the aisle. So we are hopeful that it actually will get reauthorized before we were to run out of our CHIP allotment dollars. That being said, we have started to let people know that this is a concern, this is an issue, But at the very, very early stages, because, again, we don't necessarily want to create a bunch of alarm bells and then have nothing happen, but we do want to be responsible and at least start to let them know that there is that possibility.
So it sounds like, bottom line, Judy, if you're someone who's covered under one of these programs, there's no reason to lose any sleep yet.
Correct. If you are a family who's covered either by Medicaid or the CHIP program, one, you wouldn't even know that you were covered under CHIP. But if you're on MedQuest today, the lack of reauthorization of the CHIP program is not going to lead you to lose your coverage. So that's good news for the families here. But we will have to deal with a budgetary shortfall should Congress continue not to act for the next, 2.5 months now.
Judy Moore Peterson is the MedQuest Division Administrator for the Hawaii Department of Human Services. Judy, thanks for talking with us today.
All right. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
This is The Conversation on statewide member support at Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the challenges of life on the street for homeless youth. But first, your quiz. When you hear the words Blue Hawaii, it's very likely the first thing that comes to mind is Elvis Presley's 1961 film, or possibly the ubiquitous cocktail made of rum or vodka with curacao, pineapple juice, and coconut cream. For today's Backyard Quiz, we're sharing a different Blue Hawaii. Musicians Raphael Standell Preston and Alex Agor Cowan are a techno-ambient pop duo that formed around 2010. They released a few EPs and albums, including Blooming Summer and Untogether. Though they have yet to perform in the Aloha State, the pair has played gigs throughout Europe, Asia, and North America. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us where in the world Blue Hawaii, the musical duo, is from. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Magnolia Boutique and Gallery in Kahala Mall, offering art from more than 50 Hawaii artists, featuring original art and prints, kimono jackets, hand-dyed scarves, hand-blown glass, and more. Open daily.
Few in our society are as vulnerable as homeless youth. It's a struggle for survival, made more difficult by their status as minors when laws are in place that make it difficult for them to sign themselves into shelters. We spoke with Alika Campbell, the program coordinator for Waikiki's Hale Kipa Youth Outreach and Transitional Living Programs, about the complex landscape of youth homelessness.
When people think homelessness, they kind of have an automatic mental picture of probably a severely mentally ill person with a shopping cart full of stuff talking to themselves. Mm-hmm. And youth homelessness is very different than that. And homelessness in general is much more complicated than that, too. But youth homelessness especially, there's a lot of different flavors, let's say, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, are they a runaway youth? Are they a throwaway youth? Are they part of a homeless family? You know, the different paths to homelessness impact sort of the needs and whatnot?
There are enough throwaway youths to have it be a category unto itself?
Well, I don't even really totally know where that term comes from originally. Mm-hmm. I think it's the feds. But runaway is you chose to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Throwaway is you didn't necessarily want to leave and your parents kicked you out.
Mm-hmm.
And the dynamics there are different, right? Because if I chose to leave for a whole variety of reasons, abuse and neglect in the household, sexual assault, just sort of sowing your wild oats and being out there,
mm-hmm.
That's very different than, oh, my parents kicked me out because of substance use or sexuality or something like that.
But there is enough of that to be measurable is what I'm asking.
The measuring is really hard.
Yeah.
I don't think anywhere in the country has a good count on youth homelessness because
mm-hmm.
they're a very hidden population.
Yeah.
I tell people all the time, you know, my folks are just like any other adolescent. They want to have cool shoes and, you know, wear nice clothes. And so they're not obvious. They don't stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you're out sort of observing regularly, you'll probably miss them. So for years, we've struggled with the annual point in time getting a very accurate count.
I've always wondered how that could be accurate.
Plus or minus a fair amount.
Yeah.
And it is very much a point in time thing. You know, it's the one night of the year. And youth homelessness, I think, maybe more than a lot of other types of homelessness, is very fluctuating.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm out tonight, and then tomorrow I'm crashing on a friend's couch, and then the next week I'm back out. And so I think they're in some ways maybe more transient than. And so it's not like they're out all year. I mean, some of them are.
Yeah.
But,
Alika,
yeah.
What's the day, you know, with the kids you work with, what's a day like in their life, say, in Waikiki? They get up in the morning, where are they?
At the park, at the beach, sometimes in an abandoned building, sometimes crashed on a friend's couch, but usually outside. And oftentimes you're kind of getting up with the sun.
Yeah.
And then sort of floating around kind of throughout the day. This sounds sort of bad, but if you got to be homeless anywhere in the United States, Hawaii is one of your best choices, just weather-wise, because you're not going to freeze to death. But the realities of life on the street are the same everywhere. It's day-to-day survival.
Well, when you first described that, I was thinking, you know, maybe when I was 14, I might have thought that was a romantic image,
mm-hmm.
of sleep under a tree on a warm beach,
sure.
and get up and the ocean's right there. Do some kids get into that life because of that, you know, pursuing that fantasy?
I think so, yeah. Not very many. And usually the reality of life on the street kicks in pretty early. But yeah, definitely there's some youth that maybe technically they have a home that they can go to, and they're out on the street initially to, you know, have fun and no rules. And,
yeah.
They've run away from, you know, mom scolding them about doing chores and stuff, and the initial freedom of life on the street is very appealing.
They've romanticized it.
But then after a little while, the reality kicks in. And
what realities are those, Alika? That's what I was curious
about. Again, it's day-to-day survival. It's where am I going to eat tonight? Where am I going to sleep tonight? How do I protect my belongings? And with the park closures and the sidewalk enforcements and stuff, there's a lot of people losing their belongings, having to move around.
Is that making it life tougher?
It's definitely
kids?
Making life tougher, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then for the minors, the ones under 18, the laws in terms of being able to consent to shelter are complicated. And so it's not like, you know, a 14-year-old could just walk into IHS tomorrow and have
Why
a
not?
Bed. if they're unaccompanied youth without parental consent, technically you can't really house them at a regular adult shelter. The law is, there's a little window in the law that's pretty specific about mature minors, 14 and up, 14 to through eight, up to 18, can consent to placement into a youth emergency shelter, but they can't, without parental consent, parent or guardian, but they can't, you know.
Alika, what you're describing is a setup in the law that keeps them on the street.
In some ways, yeah. In some ways, because the concept is they're not really mature enough to make good choices, and so they can, but they can consent to placement. I don't remember exactly what the wording is. It's something along the lines of they can get placement into an emergency shelter of a licensed child placing agency, which is only a couple agencies around the state. So Holly Keepers Emergency Shelter is one of them. But oftentimes the social network that they've formed out on the street is very powerful. And the idea of, I think in general, change is hard. You know, even if it's good change, it's still hard because it's stepping out of the known. And so it's kind of sometimes a tough sell.
But there are kids who could be, should be sheltered that aren't because of a wrinkle in the law. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm telling you in terms of their inability to consent for getting into shelter. And I mean, the situations are complicated, right? Because sometimes they're on the run to escape abuse and neglect and that sort of thing. But it's not quite severe enough for CPS to step in. And so the idea of, oh, yeah, call my dad so I can get into shelter, dad's who I'm avoiding. And so it's complicated.
You need parental consent, but if the parental consent just is not going to be forthcoming, either by your choice or theirs, it sounds as if you're outdoors.
Mostly. As I say, you can, there's a small little window in there. If you're 14 and up, you can consent to placement in a youth emergency shelter, but there's like 8 beds for guys and 8 beds for girls, and so it's
in the area that you work, Alika. How many kids are sleeping outside tonight?
That's always
ballpark guess.
Yeah, that's always a hard number.
100, 200.
The ones we know, I mean, the ones that I know, it's 50 to 100 probably, but that's just who I know. Average monthly attendance at our drop-in center, 100 to 150 unduplicated folks over the course of the year. When I combine all the months and unduplicate again, 500-600 people. But that's just who happens to come into our drop-in center. And there's some folks that we see out on street outreach that never come in. In average year over the past 10-plus years, we see probably 800 to 1,000 unduplicated individuals over the course of a year. But that's where the point in time, a point in time count is not really reflective of the true scope of the issue.
Alika Campbell is the program coordinator for Holly Keepa Youth Outreach and Transitional Living Programs, known as YO. It's a collaboration between Holly Keepa and Waikiki Health, and you can learn more about it on our Conversation Facebook page.
I'm Tom Gelton. Coming up on the next On Point, now that President Trump formally recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital, we'll explore the city's 3,000 years of multicultural history. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
Hawaiian Airlines has a pivotal year ahead, facing the strongest competition it has had in many years as Southwest Airlines moves into the market. Will that new competitive climate drive down the price of international inter-island air travel? Reporter Stuart Yurton has the story in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris.
Hawaiian has been operating in what might be described as a pretty comfortable environment for a while, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And it's, as you said, a very pivotal year coming up. So we'll see how comfortable the climate remains for the airline.
Well, it hasn't had serious competition of the kind it's about to face in quite a while, yeah?
Well, that's right. The one thing, though, we don't know is whether Southwest is going to be flying inter-island or only to the mainland. Mm-hmm. Regardless, there generally is an effect that is known as the Southwest effect. When Southwest moves into a market, it typically drives fares down. So the question here is that going to happen here?
Well, when the choices were flying inter-island Hawaiian or Aloha, the prices were a lot lower than they are now, aren't they?
The prices were lower when, yes, competition generally means lower prices. The issue, again, that we're looking at is what route Southwest is going to fly and whether that's going to drive prices down. If you talk to the Mark Dunkerley, as we did, they're really looking at flights from the West Coast to Hawaii and trying to get a sense of what Southwest is likely to do and what effect that might have on fares. So that's really the story here as we know it. Again, we're still waiting to hear from Southwest exactly what they're going to do. I reached out to them and they wrote back and said, we just can't tell you yet. So we don't know what's going to happen. Hawaiian doesn't know what's going to happen. And no one knows, I guess, except Southwest. And they're not really telling us yet.
Well, one question that would come up, Stuart, is if they're going to fly inter-island, would they need to do that with, would they need to bring in aircraft specifically for that purpose, yeah?
Well, that's one of many questions they would have to ask. I mean, there are questions about space at the airports. There are a number of questions that we just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we do know is Hawaiian has a bunch of new planes coming in, and that's part of the story. They have a fleet of these Airbus jets. They're smaller, and they're going to have more routes to the mainland year-round than they have now. So that's a good thing for Hawaii travelers going to the mainland. They also have a new CEO coming in, as we mentioned. Peter Ingram's taking over for Mark Dunkerley, who had a long run, 15 years, brought the airline out of bankruptcy and really kind of grew it to what it is today. So it's a big year for Hawaiian Airlines, and Southwest and what it's going to be doing is a major part of that.
Sounds as if the effect on us has yet to be fully determined. Thanks a lot, Stuart.
Thank you, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton.
Next time on The World, a love story that begins with a war.
It is tragic indeed that war should strike the South Korean people.
He was an American Marine. She was a young Korean.
And years later, I asked her, how come you would never go on a date with me when I asked you?
A love story that spans 7 decades from Seoul to Washington, D.C. Their journey back to Korea on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
This year alone, scores of Americans killed or missing from wars have been identified. It's part of the ongoing work of the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency, which does much of its work here in Hawaii. That group was reorganized several years ago following government investigations, including congressional hearings. Kelly McKeag is a retired Air Force Major General who has run the agency for about 3 months. He's no stranger to Hawaii. He was born and raised here and was commander of the agency as it underwent many institutional changes. He's back in Hawaii this week and spoke with my colleague Bill Dorman about the agency's work.
As I tell people, I think it defines us as a nation. Here we are 40, 60, 70 years later, still searching for our missing Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice.
The challenges of that work, of searching for, recovering, identifying American war dead, how has technology changed the way that work is done? And when you look ahead, how do you see that developing?
Well, first of all, the mission first began in the 1970s with the Vietnam War. And it wasn't until 2010 that the U.S. Congress directed the Department of Defense to begin searching for, recovering, and identifying missing Americans from World War II, the Korean War, and Cold War. And so in terms of technology, DNA, number one, is one of our seven lines of evidence that we use to identify missing Americans. DNA has advanced greatly over the last four decades, to the point where now we're able to take a small sample, and now the Armed Forces DNA Laboratory in Delaware is able to extract DNA from that. That's probably the greatest technological advancement, but our scientists, our anthropologists and archaeologists have also improved their technology and advancements. Particularly, I can give you an example of a clavicle matching algorithm that our scientists have developed. And what this does is it takes an X-ray, and you can take a picture of a recovered clavicle. And I didn't realize this, but your clavicle is like a unique as a fingerprint. And this matching algorithm will sort through 60,000 X-rays and determine a match and prioritize that match based upon the picture of the recovered clavicle. So scientific analysis has improved, technological advancements have improved, and our historians are able to gather information as they sort through the archives.
One of the challenges that you still face in certain areas, as I understand it, is access to areas that still may be politically sensitive. How is that for you, and how are prospects when you look forward on that?
So from the standpoint of this mission, being a humanitarian one in nature, so our efforts are recognized as humanitarian. And as such, this particular mission that we pursue is recognized by our host nation partners. And we work with 29 different countries within the Indo-Pacific region itself. And it serves as a diplomacy tool for not only the Department of Defense, but also the United States government, particularly our friends and partners at the State Department. Every country that we operate in throughout the world, except for one, looks at this as an opportunity to assist the United States on our humanitarian efforts. China, Russia, we have cooperative agreements with them. We work hand in glove with our counterparts with them. The only country that we lack that access to right now is North Korea. And having 5,700 missing Americans north of the DMZ, that obviously presents a particular challenge for us. Now, we were last operating in North Korea in 2005, but have not operated there since because of the irresponsible behavior on the part of the North Korean government.
That underlines also, you mentioned that the agency started with the focus on MIAs in Southeast Asia, but as I understand it, the numbers are still much higher for World War II and the Korean War in terms of identification challenges. Could you explain a bit more about that?
Sure. So right now there are 1,600 missing in from the Vietnam War. For Korea, it's about 7,700. And for World War II, it's a staggering almost 73,000. Now, the challenge is identifying the research, the archival information, interviewing witnesses, and what have you. So our body of knowledge with the Vietnam War is obviously more robust since we've been working with host nations, with families, with veterans for close to 40, 50 years. In the case of World War II, we're only now beginning to develop the body of research by which to be able to send teams out to excavate and recover the remains, similar to Korea. However, the soil conditions throughout the World War II areas of battle are such that when our teams are going out, we're actually finding significant skeletal remains that haven't been degraded by acidic soil, by the environment, such as we're finding in Southeast Asia. So it's almost counterintuitive that we're able to find more remains should we be able to, again, pinpoint the site in World War II and Korea.
And as you do that, you mentioned working closely with other countries. As you come across remains that are of other countries, that degree of cooperation, how is that and how do you see that developing?
Absolutely excellent. I'll give you Japan as a classic example of that. The Japanese are looking for, actively searching for 600,000 Japanese soldiers throughout the Indo-Pacific region. For us, we worked closely with our Japanese counterparts. They send teams all throughout the South Pacific, South Asia, and what have you. And so we cooperate with them. Last week, some Japanese officials came here to repatriate the remains of 13 Japanese soldiers that our teams had recovered. 2 years ago, a Japanese archaeological group had found the remains of three American soldiers on Saipan. They called us. We were able to recover those remains and bring them back here. So we work hand in glove with the Japanese government. We're very pleased, again, with the cooperation that we get from the government of Japan. We conduct forensic scientific exchanges with them, as we do with other countries. And it just serves, again, as a platform and a just another tool within the strength of the alliance between the Japanese and United States governments.
You know, I think you've mentioned several things that might be surprising to our listeners or may be something that they did not know about. Is there something else about the work of your agency that you think is not perhaps understood by the American people or perhaps a bit misunderstood by many?
I think from the standpoint of and the general awareness, I think for most Americans, when they find out that a local individual from their hometown was lost in World War II, say, for instance, found and recovered and brought home, the sense of community, the sense of belonging that that repatriation evokes is absolutely incredible. A, they recognize the sacrifice that the individual made, but then they are connected to the story, and every story is a unique one. And despite the fact that spouses, siblings have passed on, those memories and those stories have been passed on to second and third generation relatives. And so it evokes a visceral appreciation that the United States is still doing this. And it also sends a signal to those currently in uniform that they will not be left behind, that this nation will do everything humanly possible to ensure that they are brought home should they lose their life and pay the ultimate sacrifice in battle. I think that's the biggest thing. And in the case of families who have lost loved ones, Gold Star families, we have about 90% of their family reference samples on file, their DNA, enabling us to, again, identify and match remains that we may find. Similarly, for Korea, the numbers are high. But for World War II, it's still hovering at about 12% of the losses have a family reference sample on hand. And so it's an awareness from our standpoint that if individuals believe they have a loved one or know they have a loved one lost in World War II and have not provided the Department of Defense a family reference DNA sample, we would encourage them to do so because it allows us to be able to make that DNA match.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Bill, I very much appreciate the opportunity and the support that you and your listeners give to this tremendous, noble mission, humanitarian one in scope.
Kelly McKeag is a retired Major General in the U.S. Air Force, a graduate of Damien High School, and as a civilian, now is the director of the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency.
Aloha, I'm John Radcliffe from Capital Consultants of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we had Blue Hawaii on the brain. Yours might have envisioned the Elvis Presley film from 1961. are possibly the tropical cocktail, comprised of rum, blue curacao, pineapple juice, and coconut cream. This morning we were thinking about the electronic pop duo of Raphael Standel Preston and Alex Agor Cowan, who started producing EPs and albums together in 2010 under the moniker Blue Hawaii. The pair took a break from the band in 2013 to concentrate on solo projects, but last year they reunited and released the album Tenderness. Though Raphael and Agor have yet to perform in the islands, the pair has appeared in front of audiences throughout Europe, Asia, and North America. For today's quiz, we wanted you to tell us where Blue Hawaii originated. The answer is Montreal, Quebec, and nobody got that today. So our tote bag remains in its vault. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I watch as my big dreams walk behind me. They trick, they scheme, they tease.
Season's greetings. This is music director Gene Schiller. This year, HPR2 became your exclusive home for classical music in Hawaii. We're looking forward to bringing you more beautiful, timeless music in 2018. Your year-end contribution would help us mark our first homecoming and ensure many happy returns. Please give today at hawaiipublicradio.org or call the station during business hours. Thank you.
Photographers began producing beautiful images when the medium was still very young, using techniques that are cumbersome by today's standards. Tintype images that date as far back as the 1850s have a beauty all their own, a beauty that's celebrated in the contemporary work of photographer Joni Sternbach. Joni has been making tintype wet plate images of surfers in Hawaii for the past week, and she's with us in our studio. Hi, Joni.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming in. It's an unusual path you've chosen, making images the way they were made a long time ago. What led you that way?
True. It's an extremely unlikely path. When you think of the process I work with, you think more about Civil War photography than
exactly.
Surfers. Right.
Matthew Brady.
Exactly. But it's a very tactile, immediate process that you can do anywhere as long as you have a portable dark box.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been making pictures of the ocean for the last 15 years, and it just was this organic fit that worked out for me.
Describe the process for me a little bit, if you would.
The process of making it a
well,
tintype?
Exactly.
So the process is wet plate collodion. Its heyday was between 1850 through 1870. And you can take a glass plate or you can take a piece of blackened metal,
mm-hmm.
and you would pour your collodion onto this substrate. And collodion is a combination of gun cotton and ether mixed with iodides and bromides to make it light sensitive.
Uh-huh.
So you're pouring that on your plate, and then you sensitize it in a bath of silver nitrate, and you put it in the back of your camera. And while it's wet, you make the photograph. And while it's wet, you develop the photograph. And while it's wet, you fix the photograph. And you can fix the photograph in daylight. So part of the beauty of the process is that all the people around me that I'm photographing can actually see the picture go from what looks like a negative to a positive in the moment in bright sunlight.
Fixing the photographs, meaning making the image so that it stays the way it is.
Yes, but it's also like a clearing process, because when you first look at it after development, it looks like a standard negative.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. So it actually goes to a positive.
Right. And it's a very magical moment that happens, like with me and all my subjects, yes.
That's different from the fixer I used in my darkroom
days. Well, it's the same fixer, but it's just something you can do in daylight as opposed to your standard photographic paper.
Right, when we used to have that yellow light and everything.
Right.
Well, obviously there's a lot more involved with making a single image, so you're not capturing images on the fly. It's much more...
Yes.
Composition, a lot of planning goes into this, right?
A lot of planning. Months of planning went into my coming to Hawaii for these 2 weeks.
And how many images would you get out of a couple of weeks?
I'm thinking 50 to 75.
That's quite a few, actually.
Of course, not everyone is fabulous, and sometimes I take more than one photograph of a specific subject. But, that's how much tin I brought, so that's about all I can do.
Mm-hmm. You have to travel with your chemicals and with glass plates?
No, you may not travel with these chemicals.
I was wondering about
Please don't
that.
Do this at home.
Yes, exactly.
No, you have to locate them and source them locally. And what I do travel with is my 8x10 camera that comes on board the plane with me. Mm-hmm. And the chemistry is all gotten through various suppliers that that can ship to a place like Hawaii.
So you have a Deerdorf camera. You stick a wet plate in the back of it.
Right. Then I have a very dedicated wet plate back for it.
Yeah. I would think that would be extremely difficult to manipulate, you know, within different weather conditions, all kinds of conditions.
Yes, weather conditions play a huge role in the process. Humidity, wind, rain, tide, it is the thing that beats me up the most.
Well, beyond the mechanics of making the shot, what are you looking for in your images? There's a distinct texture to a tintype, for one thing.
That's true. I'm not necessarily looking for something in particular, but what I have come to notice over the years is that there is this duality of timelessness mm-hmm. that takes place in some of the pictures that I take. So there's this element of the modern and contemporary. There's this element of something from long ago.
Yeah.
It sometimes I feel as though I've sort of wandered out of the bush and stumbled upon the first people and mm-hmm. made their photograph, even though, of course, that's so not true. But the photographs have a feel like that, and they are reminiscent of when photography was used more anthropologically.
Yeah, it really, that's kind of the response that I had, because you have this sort of fool the eye effect of looking at a picture and you think, oh, this is an archival photograph of old Hawaii, and then it's a young person with a, and then you realize that's a modern surfboard. That's not a Duke Kahanamoku era
that's true.
Surfboard. And yeah, so that's the duality you describe comes through.
Yes. The other thing is that what I'm making tintypes, they're direct positives on black and metal. So the image is reversed. So all of the logos and all of the type is backwards. And so because of that, things look more graphic and they look more iconographic. So it has a different effect on the way you perceive it as a result.
There's just something a little bit off about the image. It's not just a photograph in a sense.
Right. Like if you were looking at my picture of Waimea Bay, it would be reversed and you'd go, gee, how did they get the bay on the other side?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it kind of messes with you a little bit.
Which is, you know, a lot of photography is based on the whole verite, right? The truth that
yes, photography tells so many great lies.
And I've had this discussion with people before, you know, saying, well, a photograph is an objective version of reality. And I always say, no, it's not. That a photographer can do any number of things that you don't even might not even be aware of to manipulate
exactly.
reality.
Exactly.
It's the whole idea of trying to be objective, and as soon as human intervention comes in, objectivity
goes out the window.
Goes right out the window. Yeah. But you're not even worried about that. You've sort of gotten past that concern.
I'm not worried about that, no. Photography tells a story, and that's what I'm doing. I'm telling a story about surfers, not about surfing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm not taking pictures of surfers out there on the water, but when they are on shore, and the connection between being on shore and out on the water. That's kind of what I'm hoping to inspire the viewer to understand.
What kind of things do you see in the faces of the people that you shoot?
Oh, gosh. Well, sometimes I see things like, like this one photograph I made, this guy, he looked like just a normal guy. And after I made his tintype, I've just felt like he looked like a weary Civil War soldier who was sitting on a log, you know, just getting some rest. There's pictures in photographic history that sometimes my pictures remind me of, and
yeah.
that I don't know if I'm not drawing on them specifically on purpose, but I guess I'm inspired by them and I recognize them. Little bits of them in some of my pictures.
You know, it would be curious, an experiment to take a picture like the one you just described of the guy looking like a weary Civil War soldier and dig up a photo of his great-granddad and see how much they looked alike. They might look like they were taken, you know, a couple of weeks apart.
That's true. that's part of the beauty and interesting quality to the process, that it kind of messes with your idea of time.
Well, in a way, the process has informed the whole your whole artistic vision, hasn't it?
Yeah, the process is a big part of the project in that it's in the public arena, so it's a one part. I call it one part performance and one part, you know, technique.
Uh-huh.
And it's a little chaotic working amongst large groups of people who are like all oohing and aahing around the pictures and
I imagine.
And then trying to be a chemist and a photographer at the same time.
Well, you've pulled it off, Joni. Thanks very much for coming in and talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Joni Sternbach is a photographer. We'll talk about her work at a tintype talk with Trim Magazine at the Surf Jack Hotel tomorrow afternoon at 1 p.m. You can learn more about her on the Conversations Facebook page.
Chaos is inevitable, but is it always bad? This week, two very different perspectives on chaos from doctors on the front lines of the Ebola epidemic.
People were scared. It was a crisis.
And they forgot to put an exit in.
To the messiness of democracy.
He is a master of using chaos to his advantage.
On the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 7, right after Says You.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Coming up tomorrow, the regional CEO of Planned Parenthood, Chris Charbonneau, looks ahead to 2018. You can tell us about anything you've heard on the program by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can find more information about today's topics, along with links to our daily podcast. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.